It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 224, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, what is being forced on us? Can AI help education? And website ads.
Indeed. How do we do this again? It's been a hot moment. A series of scheduled and unscheduled events have resulted in a unscheduled hiatus. So it's been, what, a month, four weeks, five weeks, something like that?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah.
It's been an interesting and busy time, so there's lots of stuff to talk about. So let's just dive in, unless you have anything else you want to preface.
No, let's go. Let's.
All right. So one of the things that has been eating at me for, gosh, I'll say the last 6 months or so, and it's coming to a head. And I won't say that it's necessarily eating at me, but it is something that definitely is eating at a lot of the people that visit Ask Leo. And it leads me to ask an interesting question that I don't think it's a different perspective on software. And that is just this. How much do we or should we let vendors force on us? Now, I say that specifically with OneDrive in mind. That's the thing that has been annoying people in a lot of different ways, mostly because Microsoft has really, really started to push hard on this, what they call backup feature in OneDrive, which basically, if you don't read their warnings properly, it just says, hey, we'll back up your stuff. Great. Who wouldn't want to back up your stuff? But the problem is it all gets loaded into OneDrive, so you may or may not realize it's in the cloud. And if you've got a free account, you're only limited a certain amount of space, and yet the backup process tries to throw it all in there, and you could actually suffer data loss, which I find inexcusable.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, we started a long time ago with, you know, them pushing really hard to have a Microsoft account. There were ways around setting up a machine without one. With Windows 11, it's turned into a game of whack-a-mole. We find a way to create a machine without a Microsoft account, and then they plug that hole, and we find a different way, and they plug that hole. So they're trying really hard to make that happen. Copilot is the most recent one for Windows 11 folks especially. It just sort of shows up, and depending on how it's configured, it'll take up some real estate. It'll, if you've got it up, if you're using Edge, it'll show up there, and it'll use your, you know, your web pages to basically make suggestions or let you do I mean, there's just a lot of stuff. And the one that hasn't happened yet but generated a ton of backlash is, of course, this recall feature for the Copilot PCs.
Right. We talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah, we did. And it's not as bad as so many people believe it to be, simply because you actually need a specific kind of PC for that feature to even happen. So, you know, your existing Windows 11 machines aren't going to have recall. If you go out and buy a Copilot, I forget what they call it, but it's a Copilot machine that actually even has a Copilot keyboard button. Then you might have the option of having recall turned on. But anyway, so the fundamental question here is, what's reasonable to expect? My sense is that Microsoft has perhaps started stepping over the line, but I'm just kind of curious if we're just thinking about this wrong, or is Microsoft really stepping over a line? What happens over in your ecosystem in the Mac world?
Yeah, you know, your description of all this made me think a little bit about, you know, Apple's got this annual cycle, you know, the new operating systems every year, and they have to come out with, here's a list of features, here's what's coming out, the new iOS, iPadOS, macOS. And they can't just say nothing, right? Nah, nothing new this year. We're going to give it a new name. And there's nothing. You know, they have to come out with some sort of list of features. And I get complaints on both ends, where I'll get people saying, I can't believe that they're not going to put this in there yet. You know, like people wanted this for years. Why isn't it even coming? Stop. What? Stop with all the updates. Like, I can't keep up. That kind of thing. And Apple does put a lot of things in there. I find, when new stuff comes out, because I, of course, do videos on all the new stuff, right? That's part of how I fill my calendar year with videos is it's like, okay, there's going to be certain added new things. And I'll do the videos on the new stuff. And I find a lot of the time I'll do videos on the new stuff. And then about maybe a year and a half, 2 years later, the feature will mature a bit and I'll do a video on it. And I inevitably get people commenting, I didn't know you could do that. You know, it's like, oh, I didn't know macOS had this. I didn't know you could do this on the Mac. I'm like, oh, this was like a big, we were all taught. I felt we were all talking about this like 2 years ago. And now it's gotten a little more mature. It's maybe they shifted a few things and I've just done another video on it. And it's like, how did you miss us? Everybody talk, you know, I felt everybody talking about it 2 years previous.
Right.
And it's kind of like, you know, Apple will put new features and they're not necessarily there unless somebody tells you that to see them. Like I'm thinking of, I don't know why I'm thinking about this, but you know, the idea that pretty much throughout the operating system now you could bring up a context menu on an image and pull the subject out of the image, you know, remove the background. It's something it's done in the operating system, which is seems weird. It's like 10 years ago, that would have been like, why is that an operating system feature? That should have been like right. in a graphics app.
Right.
And when I show people this, they're like, I don't know, we could do that. And I'm like, really? I've done a lot of videos that show using that. And but then maybe that's part of the idea is Apple will add these things. And instead of like throwing them out there in front of your face, they're just in a menu. And now you can use them or not, and maybe you won't even know that they're there. Whereas like something like Copilot or, you know, the various things that OneDrive does and all that, you know, if you cross a line and you say, well, everybody's going to be, this is going to be in your face all the time.
Weird though, because in a lot of ways, you know, what I hear you describe on the Mac side is that, you know, yeah, they add features. Whether you use them or not is up to you.
Right.
What seems to be happening on the PC side, and it's more than just adding features and maybe making them highly visible, but like especially with things like OneDrive, they're turning the sucker on whether you want it or not.
Yeah.
And that seems like something different.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's definitely a line or a blurry line, you know, between having that feature kind of always there and not. I mean, Apple definitely has crossed, you know, I hear a similar complaint, not so much about iCloud Drive, but about the specific feature, the desktop and documents feature in iCloud Drive.
Right.
And, you know, these are two very specific folders. They're in your home folder. You know, Mac's got the kind of Linux thing. You've got a home folder, you've got a desktop folder and a documents folder. And the idea was, I guess, after years of iCloud Drive being around, they made the simple change where they said, well, we'll move these two folders out of your home folder and put them in iCloud Drive instead. The idea being that lots of people store stuff in these two folders and they weren't having things in iCloud Drive. And we're just going to kind of force it on you. It's a switch, definitely a switch, but they went from the first they introduced it and you could turn the switch on, and then they made it the default. But only the default if you're setting something up new. Like it wouldn't turn the switch on for you just because you updated. But if you were setting up a new Mac, it would be on.
Interesting.
And a lot of people can make the same kind of complaint. Like, why are these files being forced into iCloud Drive? Now, for me, I see it as like, you know, I've got it on. I want my files in iCloud Drive. Like, to me, like one of the biggest features of modern computing is having my files everywhere,
right?
You know, so I use my document. I try not to use my desktop folder. I think it's messy, but I use my documents folder as my main place that almost all my files go.
So here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Because what you've just described,
yeah,
is in fact the OneDrive backup feature.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of. Apple doesn't call it a backup though. They
right.
They don't go and try to say, hey, you know, all this.
Right.
So.
They basically move your documents folder and everything in it into the OneDrive folder.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you, though. Your iCloud
has
a certain amount of space.
Yeah.
When you exceed that space, forget the documents folder, but when you exceed that space, what happens?
You get warnings, and you can't put new stuff there, but it doesn't delete it. So, for instance, you could be in a situation where you have 75 gigs of stuff in iCloud Drive, and then you change your plan to the 50 gig plan.
Oh, right. Yep.
And it'll say, oh, now you're over the limit. It will not get rid of any files, but you won't be able to put new files there. You try to save a file to iCloud Drive and be like, hey, you're full.
Right.
And yeah, that's what happens. So, I mean, it's a fairly easy thing. You keep taking files out. Part of the a problem people run into, though, is it's not as easy sometimes as just taking files out. Like you delete a file, it goes into like a trash because it's, you know, and all that. So it's still taking up space.
It's a multi-step process to really get rid of it. Yeah.
Sometimes, the way, if you really wanted to downgrade your iCloud storage and you were over the line, the way to do it would be to first get a sense of what you've got in iCloud Drive, move things to local storage,
right?
Get under that limit, comfortably under that limit, and then switch. But
here's what's happening to Microsoft book Windows users.
Yeah.
They have, I should, I mean, I'm generalizing, this isn't all of them, of course, but it's a fair number. They have a Microsoft account mostly because they almost feel like they have to.
Right.
Microsoft is pushing you to sign into your
Like an Apple ID or an Apple Absolutely. Account, as it's now being called. Yeah.
Yep. And they have, I don't know, maybe 20 gigs, 25 gigs of stuff in their documents folder, right? They've just been using it for years. There's a lot of stuff that's been accumulating. Then this backup feature gets turned on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's depending on when it happens, it can happen automatically. It can be a very misleading message that you agree to. But the bottom line is your 25 gigabytes of data then gets moved into your OneDrive. Except if you've got a free OneDrive account, which most of these people do, you have 15 gigabytes total, which means that you're instantly over quota.
Yeah.
And you must do something. And if you happen to be using email for that Microsoft account, if it's an actual Outlook.com account, you're blocked from sending and receiving email immediately.
Oh, right? Wow.
You got to do something. If you're not using that account for email, it's just annoying. You get messages, warnings, that kind of stuff. But I believe if you ignore it long enough, Microsoft will start deleting stuff. And like I said, I find that really disturbing because that to me is data loss. That to me is, years back, one of the ways that you made, one of the things that would stop the rollout of a product, and by product, I mean things like Windows or Microsoft Office, is a bug that was known to cause data loss. Those were unacceptable. And here we've shipped a feature that can cause it. It bothers me. So to bring it back on topic on the original question, though, are we just supposed to, I don't know, accept this, get angry, of course.
Right.
But the number of options, especially for the consumer, are really few. I mean, you know, you're stuck in the Windows ecosystem. Transitioning out of the Windows ecosystem, which of course is something that everybody recommends as soon as I bring this up. They say, well, you know, go to Mac, or what I really get a lot on my YouTube videos are go to Linux. That's not easy for the average consumer. That's not a trivial change. And in many cases, it doesn't even work. So voting with your feet is really hard. Complaining is kind of pointless. I'm just not sure what our expectations should really be.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I could see the issue from the Microsoft side. You know, there's that person with the 20 gigs of stuff, and they're sending them warning messages because they've turned on OneDrive. They're using 20 gigs of space. They don't, you know, they're not paying for it. Months go by, nothing's happening. What do you do? You could do more warnings. I was thinking, you could just say, you can't open this file until you move it off of OneDrive into local storage. But that's just more warnings, just like what you were saying about Outlook and stuff. It's a tough spot to be in. Probably more warning up front, you know, when you turn it on. it would be great if it said, hey, you've got a lot of stuff here. I'm not going to let you turn this on
And
until
what appears to be Microsoft's agenda, that would be self-defeating because for whatever reason, they want you to turn it on. So any wording that might make you choose not to, even if with all good intentions, you maybe plan to look at it again later, they don't want to do that. They want you to turn it on. They want you to be using OneDrive.
Oh, yeah. Even on the Mac side, they do. I mean, so if you get Microsoft Word, I don't use it too often now, but if you got Microsoft Word for Mac, the default location where stuff is saved is OneDrive.
Yes.
And it's different than iCloud Drive on a Mac. iCloud Drive on a Mac is treated like as a equal space with stuff on your drive. Like,
right.
Where do you want to save this file? You could save it here. You could save it there. You know, this is an iCloud Drive location. This is a local drive location. Go where you want to save it. With OneDrive on Word on Mac, it's like, you're going to save this file on OneDrive. If you don't want to save it on OneDrive, you want to save it somewhere else, like locally or another thing. You have to click this button.
Yep.
Go to this different place.
Yep.
Choose to leave our little OneDrive thing here and save it somewhere else. It lets you do it.
Sure.
And it's easy, of course, if you're opening a file. You can still double click and open a Word file. It's fine. But it's like it really tries to push you into the OneDrive thing. And I believe stuff like versioning, which is like something that works on Mac in all like the Apple apps and a lot of third-party apps too, where you can go back and see like the old, you know, version from yesterday of a file and stuff. Word's got that, but only if it's saved to OneDrive.
Yes, exactly.
Want to save it locally to your Mac? Nope, you can't use any versioning.
Right. Yep. Yep. It's the same. It's the same thing on the Windows side.
Oh, okay.
In fact, one of the articles I have though points people at where to change the defaults in Office apps so that it starts defaulting to your local folder of your choice rather than OneDrive all the frickin' time.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, obviously OneDrive adds features. I get that. I totally get that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody wants to use OneDrive. And like you said, if I would honestly, I would take some really draconian warnings over deleting my data any day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if it means that, you know, even worse, not just that I can't open the file, but that I can't do something else significant on my machine until I resolve this issue. I mean, sure, it'll raise a lot of ire, but it'll prevent data loss, which I don't know. So yeah, we're kind of sort of stuck in this ecosystem when we, when we're, one of the things that has subtly changed over the past decade, is while we talk about buying Windows or actually for any number of different pieces of software, in many cases, we're not really buying it. We're either buying the current version only for those software packages that don't get updates unless you subscribe, or we're leasing it, or we're renting it, or whatever
licensing
term you would prefer to use. Licensing is kind of overloaded too, because it could apply to the single purchase too. But the bottom line here is that, you know, it's not like you're buying a physical product that is now yours to do with what you want forever. You're leasing something that could change out from underneath you in some fairly significant ways. And I find that troubling. I just don't know if there's a way out of it.
Yeah, I often hear from Mac users, you know, the main reason they want to get away from iCloud Drive or get stuff off of iCloud Drive or whatever is they don't want to go to a higher tier because they don't want to pay the extra price. So it just comes down to money, really, because, you know, if Apple said iCloud Drive's free as much space as you want, then, I guess there would still be people that may not want to do it. But, you know, that takes away the main argument people have. But my counter argument that only works on the Apple side is that for the most part, Mac computers are luxury items, right? They're expensive items. Not that there isn't one Mac, the Mac Mini, that is on the lower end in terms of price, but most Macs, you're spending more than you would get with a PC. You know, PC has a whole range of budget items that you could get that are at a whole different level than Macs. And there are a lot of people that need a computer, but are not going to be like, oh, I want a Mac because I work all day on the computer and all this. I know people, older people, that they check their email twice a week, you know, and make an airline reservation once a year. You know, that's like the use of their computer. I know students that basically, it doesn't matter what computer they're using because they're in Google Docs all the time. That's exactly all they use it for. They have no files. Like, I know people that have almost no files because they don't even know what a file is. They get on it, they use certain things like email, web, documents in Google Drive, and that's it. They don't save anything. And having low-end machines is important. I mean, people with that kind of use, they're not going to go and look and say, oh, so the cheapest Mac is $699 or whatever. You know, and if I'm going to get a MacBook, it's $1,000+. Right. You know, you can go and you can get cheap PCs running Windows.
Actually, or a Chromebook is what you described, right? Where everything.
But I'm thinking in terms of like OneDrive. OneDrive and the pricing for OneDrive and all the cloud services are pretty on par. I fairly recently looked into this because people always complain, oh, why is it so why is Apple charged so much? And I say they don't. It's OneDrive, Google Drive, it's all pretty much the same, right? They have slightly different levels that make it hard to compare one to one.
Right.
But in general, it's almost the same. But the thing is, you could easily have somebody that bought a $250 PC because they have modest computer use.
Right.
For it. They maybe do a bunch of stuff with it, and now they want to use cloud, they want to use OneDrive, and now they're paying a few dollars a month for it, and they think that's expensive. And on the Mac side, if you're paying $1,700 for a MacBook Air with decent specs, or $2,500 for MacBook Pro, and you're going to go and say, oh, I don't want to pay the $299 a month, you know, I could kind of come back at you with the, really, you don't? I mean, the thing you got is very powerful. And a lot of those features are tied into cloud stuff, like being able to see your photos on your phone when you walk away from your computer, or being able to use your phone as a, you know, webcam, or you know, or sketch things on it. There's the ecosystem's all tied together. And if you don't want to pay $299 a month, but you're willing to pay a premium price for a Mac, you know, I've got a little bit of a problem with that. But that problem goes away if somebody said, I went to Best Buy and I bought a PC for $250 that runs Windows so I could do the few things I want. And now suddenly Microsoft wants me to pay $4 a month or whatever it is.
It's funny. I actually, when I think about the objections that I see to the OneDrive thing, price, while it's there, it's not. The actual number is rarely something that comes up.
Yeah.
Folks are convinced that Microsoft is doing this to get people to pay for it, right?
You know,
one of the simple solutions if you're over a quota is just, you know, sign up for more storage and you're done, right? That's the simplest solution. The pricing is amazingly cheap, honestly. The best way to get a bucket load of OneDrive storage is to sign up for Microsoft 365, which then also happens to include all the Office apps, downloadable, installable on your machine, on five different machines, including your Macs and your PCs. You know, all of a sudden with that, you know, you're paying like, I think it's $100 a year. All of a sudden with that, you've got a terabyte of OneDrive space that also solves the problem. No, what I hear more often than anything is that people don't trust Microsoft not to be scanning their documents online. And I like you have a problem with the pricing. I have a problem with that that kind of I'm reluctant to call it paranoia because that implies a stronger position than I really feel, but you know,
reluctance.
Yeah, there's concern there that, you know,
concern. By That's a
giving
good
Microsoft your documents and putting them all online, they have access to them and they could be scanning them. They could be training their AIs. They could potentially have to turn over documents to law enforcement agencies of various trustworthiness themselves around the planet. You get the idea. My response to that, though, is that Microsoft doesn't need an online service to do this.
Yeah.
They run Windows. They're
right.
on your PC already. The call is coming from inside the house.
Yeah.
It's you know, if they want to scan your documents, if they want to snag something you're doing on your PC, they already have the ability to do so. I just don't find that a credible way of being concerned about OneDrive.
Right.
I will absolutely agree with it being a reaction to Microsoft's heavy-handed tactics to get OneDrive on your machine and to get you to be using it. I resist primarily because of that, but it's not because I'm concerned about them scanning my documents. It's not because I'm concerned about the price, because it's pretty cheap. In fact, if you know what you're doing, that, like I said, you can share that one. Okay, back up. If you get Microsoft 365,
yeah,
you can install that on a single Microsoft account on like five machines. So you've got five copies of Office and a terabyte of OneDrive storage. Great. But you can also share the Microsoft 365 with, I think it's five other people with separate accounts.
Yeah.
Which means that if those five other people are you with five other Microsoft accounts, now all of a sudden you've got a total of 6 terabytes of storage for $100 a year.
Yeah.
Even if you completely ignore the Microsoft Office apps.
That sounds like a good topic for a video if you haven't done it already.
It's funny. I actually did it myself for the first time.
Okay.
I was revamping some of my online storage, and I decided to say, you know, I've got a bunch of storage here, and I got a bunch of storage there, and a bunch of storage here, because I'm sure, like you, I've got OneDrive, I've got Google Drive, Dropbox, I've got Proton, I've got iCloud. I mean, they're all competing. And for a while, I was actually paying extra for Google One. Which, if I remember correctly, if you're just paying for storage, that turned out to be the most cost-effective per terabyte. It also has the most increments. With Microsoft, I think you jump immediately to a terabyte, and then it gets, another terabyte after that. But point being, I said, you know what? I don't need to pay that, because I can just set up another Microsoft account and then share with myself the Microsoft 365, and poof, there was another terabyte of storage that I started using for some of my backing up. So anyway, yes, there absolutely should be a an article on that. But
yeah,
it's I don't know.
Yeah, the paranoia stuff, I get that too. And I know there are two different types of it. The one I don't mind at all, when somebody asks me, what do you think? What should I be worried?
Right.
This,
sure.
Can
it's a
Apple do
reasonable
can,
question. Yes.
I'm asking a question. I want to be informed.
Yep.
I don't mind that so much. What I do mind is the people that state it. Like, so I'll show, hey, here's how to do this cool thing with iCloud Drive, and you can share your files. And somebody will throw a comment in there. I won't use iCloud Drive because Apple is looking at my data, or Apple will, sell my data. And I'm like, okay, then now I have to respond to you, because you're actually making a statement and, saying something that's false.
Yes.
So.
But you can't prove it's false.
Yeah, you can't. Right. Yeah, you can't. It's just, well, actually, so I do go to, there is a handy response I have. I don't know if Microsoft has this, but Apple has a page where they have a list, a table, talking about the encryption levels for different parts of iCloud. And they'll say things like end-to-end encrypted or encrypted on the server.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll state that they cannot, if it's encrypted, it's encrypted with your key.
Right.
They can't do anything about it. So, for instance, iCloud Drive, your files are end-to-end encrypted. If they are, they can't see them.
Right.
And if somebody were to want them, like, a government of a country,
right,
or to want them, Apple's like would only be able to hand over encrypted data.
Here, have this random blob of data that you can't do anything
and,
with.
And they stay. And this is like non-equivocally stated. This is like a page that's just states all this. Not like Apple being wishy-washy about the language. Don't worry about it. You're safe with us. It's like, here it is. non-ambiguous. We'll even define what does end-to-end encrypted mean? What does encrypted on the server mean? All that. We'll define all that on this page. But, so I point people to this, and then they have a choice. Either you think on this page Apple is lying,
right?
Or if not, you have to agree that there is no threat to you. If you think Apple's lying, then you go back to what you were saying about, well, guess what?
Why are you using a Mac?
who makes the operating system? Who makes the hardware? Who makes the security, that part of the security chip, you know, that you've got? It's all Apple. So if you think Apple's lying about this, then is there any reason why you don't think they're lying about all that? And in that case, why are you even here? So, you know.
Yeah. It's funny. I wish, honestly, that's a really good feature that I would love to see OneDrive implement, is the end-to-end encryption, where I have a key that nobody else has, that OneDrive would then use for encryption before it left my machine.
Yeah.
There are third-party tools that I both use and recommend that do that in a way that is cloud storage friendly. In other words, rather than, you know, just encrypting everything as a big blob, they encrypt individual files before they leave your machine. Cryptomator, Cryptomator is the one I'm thinking of, and that's
all
the
right,
one.
You're right. Yeah.
The same idea. You've got your own key. It's on your machine. You've got your own password. The only thing that somebody that can gets access to those files in the cloud would get is another blob of randomly encrypted data. But so that's actually what I do say is that, you know, okay, fine. If you're willing to trust Microsoft on your PC, but you're not willing to trust them in the cloud, well, the only real solution for that then is encryption. And here's a tool that will do it for you.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. So yeah, I'll include that link. We can include that with the show notes in case people want to check that out.
Yes.
Yeah. It's an easy way for me to answer, because I could just, you know, say here it is and
believe
it or not.
Them or you don't.
Yeah, believe them or you don't. I mean, you know, so there you go. So
so it has been a month since we talked about AI.
The only way to stop us from talking about AI was not to have a show.
Have a show, exactly. I was listening to a podcast, actually a new podcast. It's called The AI Fix. I think they're like up to episode 6 or 7 now. It's by a couple of folks. If you've ever listened to the Smashing Security podcast, which is one of my favorites, it's one of the co-hosts of this new podcast is one of those hosts. Anyway. The thing that came up, the title is very simple. Exam submissions by AI found to earn higher grades than real life students. This got me to thinking. To begin with, there's a drop-off point, right? There's, as there are with students, I suspect, but this was up to a certain grade level. And I think we were like well into or past high school, possibly even university / college educations. The AI would do better than sophomores, but then when you get to juniors, it's the students finally do. But of course, that's going to change, right? As AI improves, we're investing more in improving AI than we are in improving our students. So AI is going to win that race. But it really got me to thinking a little bit about, a lot of the work is centered on either preventing or detecting the use of AI in the education setting. In other words, you know, teachers are just freaked out by the possibility that at some point a student will be able to ask AI to write its essay or even write its dissertation or do something like that, and then have that be undetectable from the real thing. The whole purpose of the article or the essay or the dissertation is to act as proof of knowledge, right? Proof that the individual actually learned something or accomplished something. And when they're just passing that off to an AI, it's no such proof. I'm wondering if instead of doing that, because honestly, I think that's a losing battle. As AI continues to improve, I suspect that using AI to detect AI is a game of whack-a-mole that will never end. AI is going to get better at writing naturally. And I just don't think there's a way to potentially prevent it. So how do we use it? What can we do in our educational system to make AI part of the new normal. Because honestly, AI is part of the new normal once folks graduate. It's going to be part of the workplace. It's going to be part of whatever. And I don't know, that just sort of got me thinking. I was curious if you had any thoughts on that anyways, especially since you you have a recent graduate in your home.
So. Yeah, I definitely think, well, I think that AI and education has like two different parts. And we have to be careful to, there's a really good part. We have to be careful not to hurt that. And that's using AI as a teacher. So the idea being here is the student wants to learn something.
Right.
And they are motivated either just because they want to learn the knowledge or the, you know, they want to get their degree. They want to actually really learn the stuff. And, you know, you wouldn't, certainly wouldn't stop a student in the past from reading a book on a topic because they wanted to learn, even though the book was written by somebody else.
Right.
You know, so you wouldn't, the same thing with AI, like a conversation with AI can create some very deep learning beyond what a book does, allow you to investigate a topic in a lot of different ways, and also reach a lot more students. You know, if take a given topic A, there might be 10 books on the subject and maybe a series of like video courses on it. If you can't learn from one of those, you're out of luck. You have to get another person to teach you. But with AI, you could actually have an AI tutor, and the AI can approach it from lots of different ways. You're not just stuck with like, well, these are the words in the book. If you can't understand them, tough. We got to be careful when we talk about AI education to encourage that part, the part that actually gets the human to learn the thing, whether it's algorithmic logic stuff, learning math, or actually like learning like history or
whatever. When I was in university, we had, you know, obviously we had larger classes, and so there was a professor teaching it, and he had teaching assistants. And teaching assistants were, you know, a roll of the dice if they were going to be any good at all, or if they're even going to be understandable. I would absolutely love an AI TA.
Right, or just a supplement. I mean, if the TA isn't working for you, you can always just open ChatGPT and say, I need to talk about this topic in philosophy. Can you give me a summary? Okay, tell me more about this part. Okay, tell me more about this part. Let's go back to what you said before and just have this conversation with AI. You could even ask AI, I'm taking my midterm exam on this topic tomorrow. Help me study for it.
Right.
And have a conversation that you would normally need to pay a tutor for that will help you learn the stuff. Now, if as long as we recognize, you know, we don't go and blanket say, let's get rid of AI out of colleges. We don't want to do that. We want to have this good part there. The other part, of course, is having AI do the work for you. You're not learning this stuff. You're getting AI to write the term paper. And eventually it becomes, there's no way for the teacher to guard against this. So things are going to have to change with regards, in cases where the teacher really needs to verify whether you've learned the stuff. We're going to have to move away from written tests and actually have interaction between the teacher and the students. And it doesn't have to be complete. Like you don't need to say, okay, we'll have, you know, you could still have a student write a paper and then you could talk to them about that paper. And I think within 5 minutes, a good teacher will know whether or not they really wrote that paper, right? And they understood the material. They don't need to go and spend all that time doing it. So matter of fact, AI could even help. Like, okay, so right now I have to imagine one of the worst tasks for a teacher is to get those term papers. And if you've got three classes and you have 100 students and you ask them to write a term paper and they're like 5 pages each, and now you have to read 500 pages of student papers on the same subject, you know. But you could probably ask AI to grade them, and then you could talk to each of the students about the subject to see really quickly whether or not they get it. Matter of fact, you could probably have AI to say, oh, okay, oh, the next student, let's see, in 5 minutes, I've got this student coming in. Tell me from this student's essay, what was unique about their approach to the topic?
Right.
And AI will probably come back and say, well, they took a different view to what this character in the book did or whatever.
Right.
And then you can go and ask them, why did you think the character in the book did that? And if they're like, what, you know, then you're like, okay, I gotcha. If they're like, oh, well, I really identified with them because of this experience in my life. And it's like, oh, okay, obviously, yes, you know what you're doing. You read the book, you did the paper, you had thoughts about it and all that. So it could be a useful tool. And in the end, like, notice the system I outlined there, you know, the student using AI as a tutor or a TA to more deeply understand the topic, the student still having to write their own thing, and the teacher having an easier time getting whether or not the student understood the material, but the teacher using AI to make it their job easier. So
Right.
you're using AI from beginning to end through all of that, and then you end up with the student knowing more and the teacher having an easier time. Heck, you could probably even use AI to actually like the assignment, instead of writing a paper, if that's not appropriate, could be like have a conversation with ChatGPT about this subject, and then have ChatGPT report to the teacher.
Right.
Does it seem like they understood? You know, does, you know, do they get it at the end? Do they have any interesting observations about it? And then having ChatGPT analyze the text of the previous chat and report back. There's all sorts of fascinating ways you could do it. So I don't know. It's definitely, obviously a glass half full kind of guy when it comes to education and AI.
Sure. It's funny because as you were talking, I was thinking about a completely different and probably more cynical approach. And that is the do-nothing approach. So by that, I mean, obviously, the students who want to use AI to actually learn their stuff, fantastic. Go for it. Same for teachers, right? If it helps them to do their job. But for the cheaters, right, for the ones that are using AI not to learn but to pass, which, you know, two different things, I'm almost tempted to say let them, because either of two things are going to happen. Either they're going to find a job where the AI skills that they will have developed cheating will actually serve them to accomplish the job that they're signing up for. More likely, once they hit the workforce, it will become obvious how incompetent they are.
Very much so, yeah.
And that has been the bane of cheaters ever since day one. They've all been focused on, you know, passing or getting the degree or, you know, getting the checkbox without the knowledge that that checkbox is supposed to imply. And they end up paying for it in the long run. So,
I think so too. I think the only downside is the reputation of the university, right?
yes.
They gave this person a degree, put their stamp of approval on that person's knowledge on the subject, and
Right.
sent them out, and you found them to be lacking.
Right.
But that's always been the case. And one of the weirdest things about like the American higher education system is the fact that you essentially learn the same things in the same courses, no matter what level you go to. If you go to, say, a state school, that's the cheapest option for you, and take a certain course, and you take that at Harvard, you
Right.
should be learning the same stuff. Now, Harvard may have a higher quality teacher that may give you an advantage, but you know what? Sometimes that state school also has like this amazing teacher, in certain subjects. So it's not a given, but maybe a school like Harvard or some other Ivy League school is just packed with all these excellent teachers. But the course is going to be the same. I mean, if you're taking this, whatever it is, 101, you're supposed to learn the same stuff no matter which school you're at. But what it comes down to is the acceptance rates. A school like an Ivy League school is going to get tons of students. They're going to go through that stuff, and they're going to take the people that seem to have the, like, oh, they were really outstanding in whatever they did in high school. They
Right.
participated in all this stuff. They wrote a great essay. They took the standardized tests. They did all this. The interview was just, amazing. They seem like they're really an achiever. Whereas you go to, all the way down to, say, a state school, and they may just basically accept almost everybody that applies. So the end, both students can cheat, but the one going to the Ivy League school, maybe they've tilted it towards the fact that because they let in only one out of 100 students that applied, right, that maybe they end up with 70% of the students know what they're doing. Whereas at the state school, it might be 60% of the students know what they're doing because the state school ended up with more people that were likely to cheat and not care about the information. Right. I don't know if employers care that much about it. I know, you know, for the short time that I hired people, I really didn't care what school people went to. I wasn't impressed by the name.
Absolutely. That was true for me as well. When I was hiring back at Microsoft, the fact that you went to school is nice. Now show me what you've done.
Yeah.
What are your skills? Show me your skills. Show me a track record of having created software or whatever. I cared more at that point about your ability to think correctly. I think I've talked about it before. The actual specific programming language is an implementation detail. It's your ability to think appropriately for almost anything.
Computer science, computer engineering, whatever it is you fundamentally learned, they're going to teach you the same stuff at a state school as they are, say, MIT or something like that. But
the problem is that, especially with the large companies, that doesn't scale. So what that means is that you've got to have the buzzwords on your resume in order to pass the AI, I guess it would be now, the AI that's going to be evaluating your resume to see if you make the cut to even talk to a real person.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, that's a whole other topic. And one I'm not, I don't know, it's disturbing is the whole, like, how hard it is to get a job now. And part of it is, you know, there is AI that's going through resumes and all sorts of stuff. That's all. That could be a whole other episode.
Cool. Well, anyway, so that's this week's AI segment.
There you go. So just a few other things. I finally booted ads off of some of my sites that have always had ads on them. So moving further away from ads. So I have, originally my whole thing, what I did was I had game sites, right? In the 90s, I made games that were on the web. And this is like how I originally started my company and what I do. And I made web-based games. And it was a whole new thing. You know, previously games, you had to get into stores, you had to have a publisher and all that. Suddenly you could put games up on the web. Anybody could play them. You could publish them yourself. And I created all these sites. I was the first to create lots of different kinds of games on the web. And I had tons of them up. And eventually that whole market collapsed. It was an ad-supported market. You'd play the games for free. You'd see ads. In the early 2000s, lots of companies that did not make games appeared and took games from other people and put them on their sites. And that made so many game sites that basically didn't make sense to do it anymore. But fortunately, the mobile game market appeared and a lot of those games that went to mobile games. And a lot of my games that were web-based games are no longer web-based games. You haven't been able to play them on the web for years, but you could still find them in, say, the iPhone or iPad app store. The same game. It's just there. I did, however, hold on to three games that were pretty big for me that I actually spun off into their own websites, and that's the remnants of my little web game empire, is three sites, just solitaire, just jigsaw puzzles, and just Mahjong solitaire, all.coms, all just one website, one game, lots of options, like the jigsaw puzzles, there's thousands of images you can play, the Mahjong one, lots of tile sets, that kind of thing. And they had ads on them, and the ads worked horribly because, you know, the games, all these games, you want to have as much space to play as possible. With jigsaw puzzles, for instance, you want to have a lot of screen real estate to move the pieces around. With the solitaire games, you have all these cards. You want to have lots of space on the screen to move them around and play the game of solitaire. But I had to put ads on them because otherwise there was no way to make money. And the ads got worse and worse over time. And eventually I went with a company that put ads that were just horrible, just all over the place. The page was like 50% ads. Like if you looked at it and measured the screen real estate, it was half ads. The ads were blinking and flashing and changing all the time while you're trying to relax and play these games. All three of those these games have one thing in common, and they're kind of like a relaxation pastime. So having ads flashing at you was tough. Now, since I switched over to having all these busy ads there because ad revenue was dropping, and having all these ads boosted ad revenue. But then traffic started dropping.
Sure.
Easy to see why. I didn't even want to play my own games, right? I'd go to it, all these ads. It was horrible. I would not want to play them because, oh God, there's so many ads here. I don't want to play that. But also I would cringe and say, oh, my game, I created this. I coded every line. You know, I did all this stuff. And now look how bad it looks, right? So I hated it, but I didn't have any alternative. And I still really don't. But eventually I had to, at some point, it's like, do I just want the traffic to dwindle down to zero and then declare the site's dead? You know, or do I want to, at some point here, cut the ads off and say, you know, all right, I need to just take a chance, take the ads away and see what comes of these sites. Mm-hmm. They don't cost me too much to maintain. But you know, I want the things I have and the things I made to, you know, produce some sort of revenue, just like everybody else who does work. You want to see, you know, some sort of reward for your effort. But I decided, yeah, to take ads away from all of three of these sites. I did two of the sites earlier, and then the biggest one, JustSolitaire.com, which is not just one solitaire game. It's 50 different solitaire games with lots of options. I took the ads off of that finally last month and made it ad-free, and meaning the game stretches all the way across the browser window, top to bottom, left to right. And,
yeah, I'm playing it right now, and it's kind of nice.
Yeah, and I did a few updates to it to take advantage of the fact that it now has, you know, wall-to-wall game. Mm-hmm. But the question is to see where it goes. I do have a Patreon thing going on, and I have for years, where I basically even allowed you – you could support the site using Patreon, and I had a little API thing, whereas if you proved that you were supporting the sites by Patreon, and you did that by clicking a button and authenticating, it took the ads away. And it was kind of like it was just took the ads off, but it still wasn't like you're playing right now, where it was really using all that space. Right. So anyway, I have that. My hope is that now that I actually have no ads at the site, the traffic will grow again, and that people will see fit to actually contribute. The people that play all the time, or, you know, use it as a thing that right. they go to a lot. Right. So we'll have to see how it works. I just know that, you know, when looking at it, it's like, well, if I leave the ads there, over the next month, I will make money. But inevitably, the site will die. Like, there is no, I can look at the stats. I could see there's no coming back. There's no, suddenly people are going to be okay with the ads or whatever. It's right. going to just die. So maybe before it gets too far gone, I do this. I don't know. I've had a few people start supporting the site that weren't before. I'm making about 1/10
right.
revenue that I was making before, but I did the same thing for MacMost, almost, let's see, 8 years ago. Because MacMost just was ads at the site was the main way it supported. And I took the ads away and said, hey, support it through Patreon. And I make more now directly from people than I did with those crappy ads. And I don't have to have the ads. Now, MacMost has much more of a value offer there, right? I'm teaching people how to do things and all that. And this is just like, oh, just play a relaxing game.
Yep.
Take a break. So it's harder to justify the amount. But then again, you know, the same thing could be said for Netflix, and people, tons of people play money to Netflix. I sleep better, you know.
Yes.
I like going to the sites and looking at them. I feel optimistic. I mean, there was no optimism with the ads. There was just like a slow death.
Right.
And maybe not so slow death. Now I can maybe say, well, there's possibilities. I mean, maybe traffic will start building. Maybe the number of people supporting it through Patreon will increase by a few percent every month. And maybe in a few years, I'll look back and say, oh, okay, I have more people playing now than before. more people supporting the sites directly. I don't know. I'm going to have to see. But now I still am reliant on ads in other ways, unfortunately. For instance, those games I mentioned that are mobile games.
Yes.
They have ads in them.
Sure. Sure.
They're not as bad. They're just mostly banners across the top or interstitials between like plays.
What I'm finding on the Android side, these aren't your games, but other games that I've been playing, the interstitials can get really annoying.
Yeah.
They can take a really long time, and I just want to get to the next level in Tetris or whatever.
Yeah. It can. Yeah. That's a problem. But it's at least when a lot of times when you're in some of the games, you don't even see like the banner ads. You just see the interstitial. So while you're playing, it's completely the same experience as if there were no ads.
Right.
And then you just have to put up with ads. But I do, for those games, I still rely on ad revenue for those because there really is no choice. If I charge 99 cents, first of all, I'd have to sell a lot of them to make anything worthwhile. And I just know people won't. I mean, you have to have a brand. You have to have money behind you, either a brand money, like this is a game and it has to do with this movie or this franchise or whatever it is.
Right.
Or you have to have money for marketing. And that I just don't have. Or you have to get really, really lucky. Sometimes that happens. It's easy to point to the successes and ignore the 1,000 other apps that didn't, have that success. The other way I make ad money is on YouTube with MacMost.
Mm-hmm.
So you can watch all the MacMost videos completely ad-free. They're all at MacMost.com. The same ones at YouTube are at MacMost.com without any advertising whatsoever. I have videos that are at Patreon. Those, of course, are ad-free, and you can only see those if you are a supporter. But none of the videos that have ads at YouTube do need to watch them with ads. You could always opt to watch them at MacMost.com. The thing about YouTube is that they're going to put ads no matter what. If I opt out of ads, because I can do that with a video, I can go in or with all my videos and say, don't show any ads here. It'll take ads away from inside the video, but the ads around it are still there. And the difference is I don't get anything.
Right.
Like YouTube is basically saying, okay, thanks for opting out of that. We'll keep all the money.
Yeah.
So like, I'm not going to do that. As long as I'm giving YouTube content, the deal is you're going to give me some of your ad revenue.
Right.
And I feel fine with that because I am giving people a way to see these videos without advertising. As a matter of fact, when you get my newsletter, which is also free and without any advertising, the link in my newsletter goes to the MacMost video. It's not even going to the one with the ads. So, yeah. So, but I still do make ad revenue money from places. I'm not like completely anti-ad. I'm just
as you know, I think I struggle with this as well. And because Ask Leo continues to be. Fortunately, it's not the biggest leg in the stool. You know, you're supposed to have multiple legs in your stool for a stable business.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer the biggest leg. It used to be the only leg, but advertising on AskLeo.com is still a very important part of my revenue.
Yeah.
And I'm seriously considering, alternatives to that. What the one thing that sounds similar to what you did for a while that I'm still doing is that I also have a patronage model. I'm not using Patreon, but I do it myself. And if you are signed into an Ask Leo account where you are a patron, then absolutely all the ads are gone from the site. What I do with videos is I embed the YouTube video if you are not a patron, which means that you'll get ads, the YouTube ads. But if you are a patron, then I embed the same video as it is hosted on a different service, currently Vimeo, without ads.
Mm-hmm.
So, I did that because I wanted to embed the videos, but I also wanted to stay true to, if you're going to be a patron and you're going to give me some money, you're going to have an ad-free experience, and that has to include the videos.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, it's tough. I honestly do believe that advertising right now, advertising on sites as a revenue model is seriously broken, and it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better, if it actually does get better. And, folks like us, need to be looking at alternative revenue streams if we are to survive. And it really is an existential crisis for a lot of websites because, you know, they ads are their only revenue source and that's going away.
Yep.
So, by the way, while I was playing solitaire here, I have a quibble with how you implemented the rules that I'll want to talk to you about after the podcast.
Oh, okay.
Because there's something I could do in every other solitaire app that I can't do in yours, and it annoys
okay.
me.
All right.
So, what else you got? Got rid of ads. Oh, there we go.
What's cool?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, this is actually from a month ago, but it is still cool. But it's not for everyone.
Yeah.
And that is The Boys.
Right. Yep.
They're on Amazon, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
How to put this? It is a comic book based series. They're in their, I think, fourth season now.
Your fourth season, yeah.
They've been around for a while. So it is extremely bloody, gory, profane. There's not a lot of nudity. If that's the thing that would stop you, but profanity and gore, blood would stop you, then this isn't for you. On the other hand, I've got it as a cool thing because I love this series.
Right.
I have so much fun with it. And one thing I'm noticing with this current season is that they have pulled out all the stops with regard to social commentary. In other words, the world that is set in has so many nearly direct parallels to what's going on in the world today, and they are not pulling any punches in terms of the commentary. So I'm just finding it really entertaining, and I enjoy it every week.
Yeah, I watch it too, and I was surprised because when the fourth season started, there was this, I guess it kind of went viral in social media circles because they stopped pulling punches if they really were before. And it's very much a commentary on politics today. But for a lot of people, it's always been like that. And so the surprising thing was that for people like me, I was watching, I was like, you didn't get this from the very beginning. Like, I guess, was it a little more subtle? Yeah, a little more subtle, but
the other way around, though, is that it is incredibly blatant in season four.
Yeah, season four, they're actually just some of the lines of dialogue.
Yes.
Are actually just lines of dialogue of things that are happening in the world, which is weird because you sometimes a character will say something and they're speaking all this fictional dialogue from a fictional character. And then one sentence is like, that's a sentence that is actually
that somewhere before.
Somebody has spoken that recently. And so it's really interesting to see, but it is surprising to get the backlash, from that. It's like, oh, but it was it's really always been there. And it's just, you're just now, because it's so blatant, you're just getting, anyway, it's interesting, but it does have a lot of interesting things to say. And it's an interesting take on superhero universe. I'll do something a lot more kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. I enjoyed the series, The Big Door Prize. Actually, it's just season one of that. It's on Apple TV Plus. And it's an interesting show. It's just about a small town. And one day this machine appears, like a fortune-telling machine, but it tells you your true life potential. And the little cards it gives you, usually with just one word on it, immediately it's obvious that the machine knows something. It's not the kind of thing where everybody just gets something random. Some of the things people are being told are just like, okay, this just couldn't be random. This is really specifically about me. But it really changes. The whole show is very philosophical. It changes the whole town. Even the skeptics at the beginning of the season are not necessarily that they're believing what's going on, but they've changed their behavior. Something is changing in everybody. And it's interesting to see sometimes people will take the card at face value and say, oh, I'm supposed to be doing this job. I'm going to switch careers. Other times people will interpret it differently. Sometimes people will interpret it completely like, you know, they'll just use it to justify what they want to do, even though everybody that's here is, oh, yeah, it's, the word it says here is this. And I took it as meaning, you know, and they go these steps to what they want to do. And you're like, OK, I don't think anybody thinks that's what the card means. But if that's what you want to do, you know, this is your excuse.
Good luck with that. Yeah.
So it's very interesting and philosophical, and just it really brings it, it's fascinating to watch at so many levels, and it makes you think a lot about, you know, yourself. It's like, you know, your own kind of like, what if I got a card that said something? Like, how would I react, or what would I want my card to say? Because even there are people that, you know, it's more about like, what would you want it to say? And if you did get a card that said that, what would you do? You know, if you think about it, like, oh, if I want my, what I really want to do is I want to be a novelist, right? So what if a machine told you you're supposed to be a novelist?
Right.
Would that card actually then make you do something that up until this point in your life you haven't done, even though you knew that's what you wanted to be? Anyway, interesting stuff. And it's like quick half-hour episodes and some good characters, and it's funny too and all that.
It's funny. I just added it to my list of shows for when I renew, when I restart my Apple Plus TV subscription.
Yeah. It's something I'd almost recommend to people that are both kind of in a midlife crisis situation, but also people getting started out in life.
Yeah.
Like trying to figure out who they are. Like, watch this, because it just makes you think about things and you get interesting thoughts that have nothing to do with the story. It's very clever. Yeah.
Nice. In blatant self-promotion, I did an article a few weeks ago called The Technology Behind Ask Leo. And what's funny about it is it was a revision of an article that I wrote several years ago. And it was fun to do because basically almost everything had changed. Right? I mean, my content management system was different. My web hosting is different. This is different. That's different. So if you're interested in those kind of gory details about how a website like Ask Leo is put together and how I run it, you might find that interesting. It's The Technology Behind Ask Leo, askleo.com/15110.
Cool. And I've got a video. Yeah, I find it interesting that I've started to notice that there are two things people want to learn on computers. One is how to do things, create documents and create things. And the other is how to organize the things that they create.
Right.
And there really are two separate subjects. And there are people that are very good at creating things.
Right.
And are bad at organizing. And there are people that have trouble creating things, but are great at organizing. So I've started to really think about that when I create my videos. So like I have a video that did really well. It's about how to different ways you could organize your notes. There's a notes app that's all across all the Apple platforms that people have really started using, you know, went from being a kind of an obscure productivity app to something now that a lot of people are using. It's like the main app they use all the time. And there's so many different ways to organize notes. And I find people stumble upon one way and then think that that's the way to organize. And they, you know, so I like to bring out, hey, you could use tags, you could use folders, you could do all these different things to organize. Maybe the way you're doing it now isn't the best. So anyway, I'll link to that video.
Awesome. So finally, that does it for another week after a month's worth of radio silence.
Yeah.
As always, thank you for listening. The show notes, let's see. Oh, that's right. Our 11 Labs synth. See, I'm so out of practice. Our synthetic voice to continue the AI tradition will tell you more after I stop talking. So as always, thanks for listening, and we will see you here again real soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/teh224. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.